Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Hello, this is Mickey Desai. I recorded this episode with Olanike for my nonprofit Snapcast podcast, and I thought the subject matter was germane to what Susan and I usually cover for the Inclusion Catalyst as well. So I got Olanike's permission to share this episode. This conversation was originally recorded on May 27th of this year, and it sort of speaks to more of a nonprofit management audience, but I think you'll find the subject matter to be engaging for everyone who's into diversity and inclusion and social justice. Hope you enjoy this episode. I am visiting today with Olanike Ayomide Mensa. Please tell me I pronounced that correctly again.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to take a little bit of practice, but I'm very pleased we get to sit down today, because I think the issues that you are talking about in terms of equity, diversity, and social justice are very much germane to what the nonprofit sector needs to be examining. Can you tell us a little bit more about your past and your professional history and interests with doing D&I work?
Great, thank you. Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. Any chance that I get to talk about this, I take up and I love. So thank you for having me today. So I have lived a life where I've just had to exist across different identities. I'm talking about, you know, I'm a third culture kid, which is a new label that I've just recently learned about. I'm learning more about, which just means that, you know, you don't fully feel like you're fully one thing or the other. So for me, I'm Nigerian American. I'm both American and Nigerian, and I've lived in both countries, even though mostly in the U.S. So there are parts of me that are more Nigerian than American, and other parts of me that are more American than Nigerian. And so when I'm in one country, I'm not fully of that place. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there are different ways that that shows up for me, right? I've had experience of both being very comfortably middle class, never like super wealthy, but middle class. My parents are both hold graduate degrees from a school, from the University of Missouri, actually, here in the United States. But we still, over the course of life, found ourselves in very challenging financial straits, where we were depending on donations from our church, really, to get by at some point in life. So being Nigerian American, I was born in the United States, but the rest of my family was not. So there's an immigrant story to our family story, and things that I experienced very deeply through those experiences, and the way that has impacted my life and my experience. And so there's just all these things, these intersections in my identity. And so I've just existed and gone through life in a way that I'm always noticing. It's almost like a third sense. Like when I just naturally notice difference and inequity, really, when I'm in any space. And I am driven at my core to try to fix it. What can we do to fix that? That's not right. That's not fair.
Right.
Why is that happening? Why are we okay with this happening? Doesn't anyone else see this?
So for you, it's mostly an effort to pursue injustice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Understood. It is. I'm gonna look at the notes that you sent, and you're saying here that we've been chasing diversity and inclusion issues since the Civil Rights Act, and we're making anemic progress. And it's time that workplaces face the truth about what it's going to take to see real change. Could you say a little bit more about that?
I think, yes. All workplaces have an opportunity to really start getting serious about equity, diversity, and inclusion. Nonprofits, I think, have a unique opportunity, just because we exist out of the need for something to correct the wrong in our society, whether it's some, you know, disparity in education or healthcare, you know, whatever the mission is. And the things that have been happening since the Civil Rights Act, which is when the workplace discrimination became law, therefore workplaces actually had to stop discriminating, and all, you know, all sorts of policies sprung up out of that, and efforts to to diversify the workplace, which means people of color entered the workplace, but also women, not just women of color, but white women entered the workplace as a result of the Civil Rights Act. That changed the workplace in America for sure. And when we look back over the last, 60 plus years and think about the fact that there is still very few women that are like in executive roles. When you look at the corporate side, mm-hmm. and you think about, well, in nonprofits, there are actually a lot of women in leadership, mm-hmm. but most of them don't look like me. Right. So there's a layer there, like, okay, there are a lot of women. We probably need diversity in the opposite direction in terms of gender, in nonprofits, but I don't see a lot of Black women and the data supports that. So there's still a lot of work for every sector to do, but nonprofits do have a unique opportunity just because of the nature of why we exist.
Yeah.
And the fact that, we have an opportunity to start understanding why we exist differently. We have an opportunity to start using different language to describe why we exist, mm-hmm. and move it from like an individual story to the broader story of what's happening in a community, what's been happening in our state,
right.
and in our country that have led certain people, certain segments of our population to be disadvantaged in some way, while other segments of our population have been very much advantaged.
Right.
So.
Well, the diversity field, of course, is not a linear thing. Looking at diversity is not linear. It's mm-hmm. definitely multifaceted, and it's not an easy subject for anybody to tackle, because like you've said, even if you have a board of directors that's all women, you still have to look at issues of race. You still have to look at issues of, mm-hmm. of many other sociocultural,
Right.
things. And it's not just from a hiring point of view, right? You're not just talking about the executives and the leaders of nonprofits. You're talking from a programmatic point of view too, aren't you? I mean, before we started recording, you said it was easy for nonprofits to sort of treat individuals, but not cultures. Was that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think people go to, let's just hire more Black and brown people, mm-hmm. when we talk about diversity. And they start to invest there. And there is a lot that needs to happen in the talent cycle, for sure, to get your organization along, further along in this journey. But there's a cultural aspect, that we need to look at as well. So there's a talent cycle. There are policies and procedures for everything, that you really need to look at. Not just how you hire, how do you promote, how do you give out, opportunities to people in the workplace? How, what's your pipeline look like mm-hmm. before people enter your workplace and while they're in there? What's the pipeline for leadership experience and opportunities within the organization? Who's encouraged to climb, the ladder, so to speak, and who is discouraged? I have been discouraged from applying for a senior role. Hmm. in a nonprofit education. And it's, and I've seen people with less credentials and less experience or whatever be actively encouraged. And so these are the experiences that I'm speaking from the perspective of a Black woman, mm-hmm. That I have and have spoken to others about, so there's certainly a lot of work to be done when you look at the talent cycle end to end. But there's also this cultural component, and a programmatic and even like a fundraising angle. It's really like a holistic effort, really, when you start digging into this and really hoping to make transformative change. From a cultural perspective, you have to think about like what are the things that have just sort of become like just the way we are and just the way we do things around here, that we just live with and accept, and we are invested in this as the right way to do things because of whatever the history and the story of that organization is. And should we accept those things as how we continue to be? Because a lot of times for people of color, those things are those are the stakes in the ground that are actually working against equity in a workplace. you know, the we've always done it this way. Of course, we always recruit from these colleges. It's a great liberal arts university, and they always give us great, you know, thoughtful young people who are passionate about blah, 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 blah.
Right.
But I've been in those interviews where there's someone sitting across the table from us who has lived the life experience of our, you know, clients or our population, if you will, and who are bringing a totally a different set of really valuable insight and perspective that we don't value as much as we value that, whatever, sociology degree from Brown or, right. or whatever it might be, right?
Right.
And it's not to say let's completely swing entirely in the opposite direction, but what are these things that we just kind of use to filter in and filter out people? Let's look at that, and let's look at how that shows up in our culture. What do we encourage and value versus not? Who are we encouraging and why, and who are we not?
Right.
Is there a lot of work there?
Yeah. Is there an organized way to get a nonprofit to look at its practices in those areas?
There are. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can get consultants to come and put a whole structure, you know, program and structure together and sort of walk you through it. You can also do it yourself, right? But I would caution organizations to, throw this work on staff that have another job already, especially your staff of color, because that's a lot. That's also a lot of what happens.
Oh.
We need to get, you know, we need to fix our culture because people are leaving. Our turnover is higher for, you know, Black women. So, hey, Alani K, you're a Black woman. Can you work on this side project? It's a stretch opportunity, but you're giving it to me because I'm a Black woman and you want me to take this on for the organization, this thing that's a full-time job in and of itself in other places, this thing that you could pay a consultant to come do so that I don't have to stick out my neck in the place where I earn a paycheck,
right,
to feed my family, to tell you all the things that you don't want to hear.
Right.
You know, there are certainly organized ways to go about this, and you can also do it internally, but you have to be very careful if you do it internally, because the trap that folks fall into is, yes, you should be seeking the input of the people in your organization. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you have Black women in your organization, listen to what they're saying.
Yep.
But be very careful about sort of giving them extra projects and extra things to do. Just basically, like, you know, having them have more on their plate than others, and the kind of sort of this free labor that they're investing into the organization at greater cost because of who they are.
I can see that could easily be a double-edged sword for everybody involved, not just the employee, but yeah, that's, I think you're right. It's always better to get a third party pair of eyes on the issue. If to do nothing else, but to just decrease the possibility that political strife is going to occur as a result. Mm-hmm. But that's just me.
for sure.
Right. So let's pretend for a minute, let's say you've got a nonprofit that does some work, in a social justice field, you know, getting a third party person to get them to take a look at themselves and make sure that they're hiring and recruiting, and treating, right? So even in the mission oriented work that they do, is it still wise to get a consultant to help them figure out if they're, you know, treating the populations that they need to be treating in order to address a cultural problem? Are we talking about that as part of a program assessment, or how does that work?
Let me make sure I understand the question.
I'm asking the right question. Yeah.
You're asking about the outward facing work that an organization does.
Correct.
And how should organizations or should organizations be looking at how they deliver that work in a way that's culturally appropriate and sensitive and mindful? And is that
right.
Was that question?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, because what we were saying in the very beginning was that, you know, before we started recording, you know, it's easy to treat individuals and individual families without a real anchor in culture. And so how then do you move from treating the symptom individual to treating the, right.
Yeah. I think, I think there's actually two things. There's a cultural, there's a cultural piece, but there's also just like the historical piece. they're going to overlap, right? But if you're treating a community, if you're working with folks that are in a particular community in a city, and the storyline, you know, when you're writing, you know, up your proposals and, you know, documents that you're using in order to talk about what you do and fundraising, and you're having your meetings with donors and et cetera. If the story is this individual has these failings in life and we are the savior and we're coming to save them and we need your money to do that, or we need your support or your partnership to do that, without thinking about, well, why does that individual have these failures, as you call them? What are these things that we've just attributed to this person, to this individual, as personal failures? And have we looked broader at what is happening perhaps in that part of town, in our city, in our state? What are the decisions that have been made in the broader system that have led to this community being, burdened with these challenges that are now showing up in these ways? So I think those are questions that organizations can start to have just as part of whatever it is that you do today. Thinking about what is actually the history? What happened 20 years ago in this city and in this community, in this neighborhood? What about 30 years ago? What about 50 years ago? And, you know, just kind of thinking about how all of these things and all the decisions that have been made well before any of us got here still are reaching into the present and having real impact and producing what we're seeing, and changing how, not only how we talk about those challenges, but changing how we maybe deliver our programming, right? In one of the workshops that I do, there's an exercise of looking at gatekeepers. and we talk about like what a gatekeeper is in an organization, in a community, et cetera. But there's also this exercise that talks about like, what are the systems that are reaching into communities, especially, you know, the Black community, the Black section of town, or the, Hispanic section of town, you know, like, you know, in some of our cities, we are very, very like geographically segregated. And it is, you, if you're from that city, you know,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Many cities are like this, you know, Chinatown. I mean, that one is even, we just labeled it.
Yep, exactly.
We know where Chinatown is in all the neighborhoods, in all the cities.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. And so, but what are the systems that are reaching into those communities? Who's controlling, who has the power to control how resources move in and out of those neighborhoods, and how does that impact the people there? And if we're a nonprofit, yet another organization coming to come do, you know, our version of good in that in that community, are we looking at the systemic things that are already happening in that community, and where are we fitting in? Are we coming into a community telling them what they need because we feel like we figured it out, or are we actually leveraging the wisdom and the insight that already exists in community? Are we partnering with a community versus coming in to, you know, sort of be in this kind of sort of charitable manner to like do some charity work
in a
community that just doesn't do anything to disrupt the cycles and the things that that have caused that community to end up there, but we're just, you know, here to do some charity work and be here forever, not really change anything. There are big questions for sure, and there are no easy answers. I, by no means is this an easy thing to do. But I do think organizations grappling with these questions, with how they deliver their work externally and how and who's doing their work and who's in what seat, you know, internally, you know, this is all really important work.
Yeah. I think in some cases though, you're talking about problems that are generational in nature. I mean, these are, you know, like poverty actually is generational and stretches back a long time.
Yeah.
So I've heard in your notes, you also say that you spend most of your time working, helping organizations look at their policies and procedures, taking a look at their organizational culture. What other things do you do for organizations to help them look at these issues?
So we look at culture and how do we transform culture? What are the things? And it's, you know, each organization has a different way that their culture is, like their culture developed, and how it's maintained today and reinforced. And so that will look different from organization to organization, but looking at your culture is really important because you can have language and policies and procedures that are actually read really well on paper, but that does not necessarily mean that that's the lived experience of people in your workplace because of culture. So that's one end. So there's like the policies and procedures that underpin all the things that happen in an organization, not just from a hiring perspective, but for like programmatically fundraising, all the things we've talked about so far. And then there's, you know, the culture. What is the lived experience? How are you gathering that information? How are you looking at that information and respecting whatever the information is that you're getting and really tackling whatever it is that you need to get to a better place?
Mm-hmm.
And that's assuming that you've decided as an organization that you have a vision for something different, right? From wherever it is that you're starting out. So the culture is important. We haven't talked about the board and governance too much, but that's also really huge. A lot of times in organizations, the staff, middle management, sometimes even the leader, like the executive director perhaps, is on board and they see the need, they feel excited about trying to do something differently. But if their board is not ready to support and back that, it doesn't really go anywhere meaningful, like anywhere sustainable even. And so the board piece is really important, and board governance is a whole beast in and of itself. anywhere, not just in the nonprofit sector, really anywhere.
Yeah, it's true. I'm sitting here nodding my head. No one can see me, but I'm like, oh yes, it definitely is. Yes.
Yeah. So this is like yet another angle too. Like, how is your board enabling and supporting your organization to be able to do this work? It's big. They can derail you, or they can really just like be the wind beneath your wings.
Yeah.
To get this work done. And they have to do the work for themselves as well, which is the hardest part. It's like, mm-hmm. it's not just like, you know, approving this or that thing to happen. As a board, you're making decisions that are impacting this organization. How are you doing that?
Right.
In a way that is like fully equitable and aware.
Mm-hmm.
That's an area that I'm hoping to get into more in the future. I don't do too much of that now other than sort of free advice on the side to people. But it's my God, it's something.
Yeah.
So you're saying
you would like to work more hands-on with actual boards in looking at these issues?
I do think at some point. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right now. So my work has really been working with, like executive directors and like directors of different, like those are usually my point people in an organization, is like the ED or the top, whatever the title is for the top person mm-hmm. in the organization, or some member of the management team reporting to that person reaches out and says, hey, we, like the director of development or the director of like talent or people is oftentimes where it comes from, to say, hey, we're having this challenge and we are looking for someone to help us either do an assessment of some part, some component. Many times organizations have already had some sort of assessment, but they need support executing that plan. And executing it in a way that's really mindful of what these challenges are that they've now learned about. That we're sort of lurking, you know, underneath the water. And now they're like, oh crap, now we have to do something about this, but we don't want to upset people even more. Like, how do we move forward? And so I get to come in and sort of partner with them to start doing this work. And I also do one-on-one coaching. So I'll mm-hmm. coach, you know, and I do some just management leadership development as well. But I'm obviously doing it with this lens. I think sometimes those, you know, diversity work is separate from leadership or management development when they need to be, it's a casserole. It needs to be all in there together.
Mm-hmm.
So I do a lot of one-on-one coaching. And I also coach like leaders or managers that are in charge of diversity work, or are doing like, you know, the talent management or talent development mm-hmm. work in their organizations. So we'll do coaching, like, you know, tell me what's going on. You know, like sometimes there's incidents that happen and they just need someone outside yep. of the organization to talk them through it and like point them to this resource or that resource.
Yep.
And then, you know, the easy sort of easiest thing that I do, not easy, but the simplest thing I would say that I do is just kind of trainings and facilitation, just kind of come in for a day or two and, you know, lead exercises and workshops, you know, tailored right, to the organization right. to help them start to think about things. And mm-hmm.
Do you think an organization's philanthropic practices, let me rephrase that. Do you think an organization's fundraising practices should also be looked at with the diversity lens or diversity with an equity lens?
Absolutely.
And what yeah. does that look like exactly? Because in my world, fundraising is all about stewardship. It's all about making, you know, the appropriate ask to the appropriate person at the appropriate time. So I'm not sure how I would put a diversity lens on that picture.
Yeah. I think the best, outcomes come from like relationship, right? Mm-hmm, the right. stewardship. You know, if you have a relationship, you have a strong relationship with anyone in any context, things are better. Whatever the outcome is that you seek is easier because there's a connection and there's a relationship. I think what happens is, you know, fundraisers are, you know, chasing a goal. We have to raise this much by this year, this much this year. And so in order to do that, to be effective, in that you want to sort of go for where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. mm-hmm. And you want to be, and then in trying to build steward and build that relationship, you want to compel them to get bought into what you're doing. And there's actually an educational component when you're building a relationship with, you know, a prospect. That I think is an area that, fundraisers should examine. And I was never like a director of development. I was more on the programming and staff development side in my nonprofit experience. So I was always oftentimes just in the room, mm-hmm. with the person actually, you know, engaging the foundation or the donor or whatever it is, you know, to speak to the program side while they're kind of, anyway. So. Mm-hmm. Those are moments where I would cringe a lot when I'm sitting there and sort of hearing the language and the stories that are being told in this relationship building education, what I saw as really educational moment for the donor to understand what we're about, what our clients and students and people are about and how they got to be in the situations. Again, right? Like, how do you tell that story that says, yes, these are the data points for the population that we're serving, but we're also aware that there are broader systemic things that are going on in this community. And we're not just saying this student is in this situation because they had bad parents.
Right.
Like, you know, because there's this component of like trying to appeal to donors to get them to give to you that is very, very nuanced and tricky. And I've seen people do it really well as well. So I don't want to just paint, you know, a terrible picture here, but there's a TED talk that, circulated a while back. And I think I still see it pop up every now and then, The Danger of a Single Story. And that was something that I know hit a lot of, fundraisers hard.
Yeah.
And the organization that I worked in at the time when that TED talk was released, I mean, we totally changed like our gala and how we tell stories and how we like coach students to tell their stories. The TED talk is by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. So she talks about, I think it was, mm-hmm. I believe it was her TED talk. But it's a great one to go watch and to just really think about, like, we are used to telling a certain story about our people, the people that we work with, that is really positioning ourselves and trying to position the donor as the savior that's coming in to completely change their life. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, that very well might be the case, right? But how can we diversify the story that we're telling and honor the people that we're here trying to serve by recognizing the bigger picture of what their life is as a result of all these other things. And how do we educate our donors in that process so that they come into a new awareness, and then they can be engaged with us, compelled to support the mission with that full story, not just a single sliver that we want to package and make really simple for them to digest.
Right.
And it may not be, maybe you don't hit your goal because you didn't get this person to give you $300,000 this year. I don't know. But if you actually were successful in telling that story and giving them the full picture, and I mean, the authenticity and the power that comes for that, I think actually will ultimately in the long run be more beneficial to your organization and to that donor themselves becoming more aware in this way. Mm-hmm. So I think the language and the story that we tell donors is one aspect. I do want to say though that there is the philanthropic side of it, where our foundations also have some work to do. You know, there's data out there about organizations that are led by people of color not getting as much funding as organizations that are led by white people. And it's really disheartening. I mean, the whole sector has work to do.
Sure.
From the programmatic level to fundraising to the board to the philanthropic community, there's work for everyone to do, but it's expected. I mean, we live in a country that where this is just what's in the air. We all are living in this broader context of inequity, mm-hmm. right? And so there's so much that's been happening for centuries to get us to where we are today.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so complicated and so complex and so layered, but it's so worth it, because for the people that are feeling the weight of all of that injustice and inequity for all this time, to be in a space in an organization engaged as a donor where we're talking about it, we're addressing it, we're trying to do better, it is like life-giving. Yeah. To be in that place, and you would be amazed like how much more loyalty and commitment you get from folks when you start to name these things and work on these things that so often are not named.
Yep. No, I think definitely loyalty and commitment are the name of the game for sure. Well, Anika, this is wonderful stuff. I wish we could talk about it forever. If a listener wanted to get in contact with you, how would you suggest they do that?
Oh, so you can start with my website, and my website has all the other things on there. Mm-hmm. So my website is www.mosaic4equity.com, and the four is the digit four. So it's mosaic, the digit four, equity.com. Mm-hmm. Email address is info@mosaicforequity.com. I have an Instagram handle and I'm on Facebook. Mosaic Consulting is on Facebook as well as my personal profile. Instagram handle is @mosaic_4equity. And so, yeah, but all those things.
Yep. You have all the ways.
I have all the ways. Facebook too.
Right. Yeah. And I thank you. I hope we can get together at some point in the future. I'd love to talk some more about the issue of philanthropy and equity. If there's time to do that sometime later this year, I would love to revisit. And in the meantime, thank you for joining me for this episode. I'm glad we got to make this recording today.
Thank you. If I could say one last thing that I think is really key for whatever the function is, the area of the sector that we're trying to tackle, I think the biggest way for folks to make a real difference, transformative change, is to be willing to let things go that we're used to doing. We've always done it this way. This is how we do it. When someone challenges something that you feel a strong reaction to holding on to, that's the place where you need to dig in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, because until individuals are ready to be outside of their comfort zone, and be okay with letting the way we've always done things, or the way things are, or the right way, air quotes, go, we're not going to see real change. We're going to see rhetoric. We're going to see surfacey efforts. We're going to see unsustainable things that are going on. And in the end, that actually does more harm, I think, than good. Right. Yeah. So I would just really encourage people to really think about what are these ideas, what are these practices, what are these sort of beliefs that we have that are stakes in the ground that we need to let go.
Yep. Agreed. Again, thank you, Olanike. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.